Hi, this is Dark Journalist. Today I have an exciting interview for you with Niara Eisley, the author of the new book, Facing the Shadow, Embracing the Light. In the book, she describes her amazing experiences as a UFO abductee and her time in a secret military experiment involving mind control and reverse-engineered ET craft. Now, UFOs and military abductions, or MILAB, take us deep inside a shadowy world of covert operations and secret space programs, advanced technology, and alien hybrid children. What's it all about? Well, we're going to find out. Fair warning, you may never look at the moon the same way again. Here we go. Former United States Air Force Sergeant Niara Eisley. UFOs and military abductions.
There's only one war going on this planet, and it's a war against consciousness expansion. And they are doing anything and everything they can to keep consciousness from awakening in humanity on this planet. And so we need to ask ourselves why. Why are the powers that be on this world doing everything they possibly can, almost with a sense of desperation, to keep humanity from collectively awakening their consciousness?
Niara, it's great to have you here. Your story is so interesting and complex. What I'd like to do is start at the very beginning, some of those early encounters. So can you tell us to start where you grew up and had some of these early experiences?
Well, kind of two places. I was born in Southern California, lived there till I was about 11 years old, and then moved to Ohio. Oh, terror. I was like, oh, no. Not from California to Ohio. So anyway.
It's a little less glamorous.
Yeah, so we moved to Ohio. But I think the experiences started in childhood there, and then they continued in Ohio.
Now, you had some abduction experiences as a child. Did you ever wonder how they came to choose you?
Well, I think they're generational. It's something that if you're the son or daughter of a abductee or experiencer, then you're next up in line, because they're very interested in our genetics. And my father was the one that was the abductee, so to speak. And he was the one that actually got me interested in the subject when I was a kid. He handed me all three of Eric von Daniken's books, Chariots of the Gods.
Those are good books.
You gotta read these, yeah. So that's kind of how it started for me. But they do follow bloodlines, and they seem to like bloodlines that are like close to the original human. So they go for people that have Native American genetics. Notice that a lot. A lot of Cherokee people, or people with Cherokee in their bloodline, are also ET experiencers.
Now that's interesting, because it reminds me of John Keel's work on the Men in Black. You know, he would take the witnesses who had encountered them and show them pictures of different race groups. And over again, they chose these Laplanders, who are the original indigenous people from Norway and Scandinavia. So that really fits with what you're saying in a fascinating way.
Good. Even when you look at my eyes, if you can see my eyes, there's like this fold here. That's a Cherokee feature. The way my eyes are formed.
Yeah, so they can track you and sort of target you. But how do you remember these early encounters? When you think back, how do those early ones strike you?
The early ones? Well, the one that really crashed in on me was the nightmare of being left alone under the street lamp. Mm-hmm. And that was probably my earliest memory. I didn't realize at the time it was an abduction. It was just a nightmare that I woke up screaming from. And it was the one and only time I ever woke up screaming in my entire life. Mm. So that was kind of a red flag.
Yeah.
And so when I looked at that memory with Bud Hopkins under hypnosis, we found that it was an abduction. And the thing that was a flag for him was the fact that I was left alone under a street lamp. Because when people are getting an examination by ETs, usually they're on some kind of surface or table under a light.
Uh-huh.
So that was why he thought that there was something more to that dream.
Do you, can you tell me the dream?
Yeah. I was having a dream that my sister came and got me with two friends, but I couldn't see who those friends were. They were kind of faceless. And she took me out of the house in the middle of the night, and she took me to a, there was a dark street we were on, and she left me alone under a street lamp, and she said, "Stay here till I come back and get you." And I said, "Okay." I was 4 years old, and it was pitch black. Every place where the light wasn't touching the street was pitch black. So it was like a Alfred Hitchcock scene where I'm in the middle of this light on a dark street, and every place outside where the light is touching is pitch black, and I can see nothing. It was terrifying for a four-year-old girl. And so I stayed there, and I got more and more scared, and then finally I started screaming, hoping she would hear me and come and get me, and that's when I woke up screaming in my bed. And I was terrified, and the kind of the best thing my mother could think of to do was like say, "Shh, shh, shh, you're going to wake up your dad." You know, hug might have been nice, you know.
Yeah, that's not very helpful somehow.
It wasn't.
Your sister. This is an interesting image to use. It's a vision of safety, in a sense. And so do you think they plugged that in because they wanted you to come along? And then at a certain point, you realize that it's not her?
Well, yeah, I think they did screen memories with my sister. Because I remember in one of my hypnosis experiences, I think one of the ones with Gloria Hocker, I saw her standing on the ship while I was getting some kind of exam or procedure done. And she looked so calm and so peaceful. And I'm looking at her and I'm thinking, if she was really here, she would neither be calm or peaceful. You know, she would be hysterical.
Right. Yeah.
And so for some reason, when I thought that, it helped me to see the ET that was projecting the image kind of behind her.
Oh, and what did it look like?
It was like pretty much a typical gray, you know, one of the tall ones, I believe. And it was, you know, it could see that I was seeing it, and they sort of, they would try screen memories every so often, but they knew that after that time they didn't really work with me. They would still try it, but, you know, oftentimes I could see through it.
Very interesting. How do you feel about them, the gray aliens?
Well, if I didn't have the contrasting military experiences, I might be pretty mad at them. But I've had 14 years. See, this is kind of the strange thing about me is I waited 14 years before going public and writing a book and everything, and I never had any intention of ever going public or writing a book.
I think that's pretty clear.
Yeah, and the reason I wrote the book was because people were getting so hung up on the horror story of what happened to me in the military that I just thought I've come so far from that. And people have to know that there is hope and healing after experiences like that. So I wrote the book. But back to your question, which was about the military experiences in contrast to the ET experiences. Okay, two things. With 14 years to process the experiences and all the things I've learned about the grays, that I've come to accept because of my experiences, I'm not really that mad at them anymore because they're really trying to save their species. And when I think about it from the standpoint of human beings, if our species was in danger of extinction and the only way that we could survive in any form was to take genetic material from a different species, do you think we would stop and ask permission?
Right.
Or would our need be so great that we couldn't afford to get the no?
Yeah.
If we had permission. So I kind of forgive them from that standpoint. Then I have the military experiences where horrific things were done to me in a very brutal fashion by human beings, or at least people that looked like human beings. And that has provided quite a counterpoint to the ET experiences, because the ET experiences were TLC, tender loving care, in comparison.
Right. So you could say that the Greys, then, when they were abducting you, They were doing it for their own purposes. It was inconvenient, but it wasn't necessarily terrifying, or there wasn't the brutalization that came later with the military abductions, which we'll get into.
Yeah, well, it was terrifying to be with the Greys, and very strange and very wild, but there was never a malevolent feeling coming from them. They were just clinical. They were clinical. They were scientific. They just wanted to get their study done. And there was no intent to inflict harm that I could see or feel. But very different with the military experiences. They were definitely maliciously inflicting harm of the worst kind.
The Greys were interested in your reproductive organs, and they were interested later in your sex life to a certain degree.
Yes.
Did you find that you found that you had pregnancies that were associated with them? How did all that come about?
Well, I'm not like some women that run to the doctor at the drop of a pin. I actually avoid doctors like the plague. But every time I did have to go in for some kind of, you know, female thing, they'd do a pelvic exam, and then they'd say, you know, are you pregnant? You know, and it wasn't the cursory question about, are you pregnant or do you have blah, 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 you know, going through the list. It was, they would just look at me and say, are you pregnant? And I'd say, no, haven't been with anybody. There's no chance of pregnancy. But then finally, you know, they said this to me many times throughout the years. You know, one doctor or another would ask me this question. Finally, I said, why are you asking this question? And he said, your uterus is enlarged. Well, I did have some endometriosis when I got my hysterectomy in 2008. But I don't think that it was an ongoing problem during my reproductive years. So I don't know. But then the other thing that really points to the fact that something was going on was when I was 35, I had my tubes tied. And when I had my tubes tied, the doctor went in under local anesthetic, so I was awake for the procedure. And when he got into the abdominal cavity, he said, my God, you're full of adhesions in here. Have you had any other procedures? And I said my usual thing, no, I stay away from you doctors as much as I can. And I kind of chuckled a little bit because he was very concerned and I kind of wanted to lighten things up a little. And he said, well, he says, your whole abdominal cavity is full of adhesions, as if you've had other procedures. Mm-hmm. You know, so I didn't know what that meant, but I found it very disturbing. But then when I had hypnosis with Gloria Hawker, I found that that's how they were going in with a needle, you know, a special needle through the belly button. And then they would probe around into the uterus until they found the fetus, and then they would remove the fetus with that probe.
They take a fetus just generally as an estimate, maybe after 2 or 3 months?
Yeah, within the first trimester.
Okay.
They probably take it as early as they can. That gives it the best chance of surviving outside the mother's womb.
When do you think that started?
I think it started in my teens. I think it started shortly after my first menstrual cycle.
At any point, did the Greys tell you they were doing this, or did you have to figure it out?
I had to kind of figure it out from my hypnosis sessions, you know, observing, you know, or re-experiencing really what happened to me under hypnosis. And then taking that information, I started studying what other people had written about the Greys, about things that they've been looking at to try to make sense of what's really going on. And there's pretty big consensus out there that it's a hybridization program, that they're using human genetics to try to revamp their species. And their species, this is the explanation I found, and I at first rejected it because it just sounded too fantastic to me. But I've kind of come around to kind of accepting this this explanation until I get a better one. Mm-hmm. And that is that they are doing a hybridization program, and even though they don't look very much like us, they're very close to us genetically because they are us in an alternate timeline. Mm-hmm. In the alternate timeline, they destroyed their world in a nuclear holocaust. And because of the emotions and passions involved in the war, they decided emotions were bad. So they moved underground to get away from the fallout, and they bred themselves into a species that reproduced by cloning rather than sexuality. And then they lived that way for, you know, maybe thousands, maybe even millions of years. But as they did the cloning process, they realized that when you make a copy of a copy of a copy, there's genetic degradation. Mm-hmm. And there's the genetic degradation, something is lost. So they started realizing that by manipulating their genetics, they lost some vital things by going from sexual reproduction to cloning reproduction. And so now they're using us to try to put back sexual reproduction and put back the emotions, hopefully, and use them from a wiser place.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's very interesting. Well, do you think that with the Greys, then, do you think that they're coming from an off-world place, even if they were us at some point? Do you think that they're coming from a different solar system?
Yeah, I think they're coming from a different solar system, and they may even be coming from an alternate dimension. Mm-hmm. And again, you know, I kind of, that, you know, at my stage of research and education in this subject, I kind of, you know, I would say two-thirds of me accepts that that explanation as for real, but I'm still waiting for more data to fill in what's really going on more.
Sure, I can appreciate that. Well, there's so much we don't know about them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Do you feel like they stopped abducting you at a certain point?
Pretty much. Once I got past the childbearing age, and of course I don't have my uterus anymore, so I'm not really much use to them that way. I think they do pick me up once in a while, once in a blue moon. I'm thinking maybe once or twice a year, just as kind of follow-up, you know, to check on certain things that they may have done to see how it's still working or whatever.
Okay, so you went through these experiences. You had a series of pregnancies that they were able to obtain fetus matter from you, and they eventually created or went to create hybrids. In any of those recovered memories, did you ever see any of these kids full grown, or did they ever allow you to do that?
I did see a daughter that was full grown. And I didn't see her under hypnosis. I actually saw her psychically when I was having some kind of healing around this issue, an energetic healing. And I had my eyes closed, and I could see my daughter, and she looked very hybrid, thin, wispy hair. And she looked like she was really working right alongside the Greys. You know, she's one, you know, in their culture and their society. But I really got a strong impression that she did have some emotions from me, and that they were a source of some difficulty for her in assimilating into their culture.
So, oh yeah,
she was doing her best. Yeah.
Do you think if she were to come here and mm-hmm. you know, be here with you, do you mm-hmm. think that she'd be able to sort of cope with the society, or is it when you grow up with the Greys, you need to stay there?
I think she needs to stay there since she's grown up with them. I know that she can survive in this society. We live in a very traumatic society. It's been a traumatic society for some time, but it's really been, we have kind of a culture of trauma since the 9/11 incident,
uh-huh.
I think. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's interesting, actually, because it is, you know, very militarized. Let's go to your military experiences, which are fascinating. And you spent a lot of very quality time in the military and did an excellent job. What was your title in the military?
You go in, you're a buck private, and then you work your way up. And I made E4 sergeant by the time I got out. So that was my exiting rank.
And yeah. They moved you to a series of bases, and at a certain point, a base called Tonopah?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
That's the base, and then
the town. There's a town called Tonopah.
Oh, okay.
And then Tonopah Electronic Warfare Range.
Okay.
And they just changed it before I left to Electronic Combat Range. So there's Tonopah Electronic Combat Range and Tlecha Peak Electronic Combat Range. And this is where we trained pilots to fly against auto-track radar, which is a targeting radar for shooting down aircraft.
So you were a radar operator?
Yes.
Okay, and these pilots are training there. You remember going there, but you have about 3 month gap of memory associated with that the time you spent there.
The time at Tonopah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you've recovered some of that time. What is it that happened at Tonopah?
Well, besides my usual work duties, I was taken out in the middle of the night to test the radar on so-called special aircraft. And so we were in the radar van. We did not see the sky or the aircraft that night until we exited the van after the test was over. But in trying to run that test, we found that these special aircraft could not be tracked. And we'd get a very brief, maybe couple-second lock on the aircraft, and then it would take off, and it would just be gone.
Wow.
Part of the sky.
That's pretty exciting.
Yeah.
And this was in 1980, somewhere in there?
Yes, January in 1980. It was probably, you know, say January to March, April of 1980 was when these experiences happened.
So you're there on the secret base doing radar tests on these advanced craft. Now, did you get visual contact with the craft enough so you could see what they looked like? And can you describe them for us here?
When the test was over, we were told to go out and wait on the deck. And, of course, the saucers were still in the sky. So we're looking up and we're seeing these, flying saucers. And my attention was kind of riveted on the one that was closest. So I wanted to, like, really see the detail and kind of put it in my memory because it was remarkable what I was seeing. It was also terrifying.
Sure.
Because of the classification that I felt what I was seeing must have. And I had a secret clearance. So it was terrifying for me to see that and realize that my clearance wasn't nearly high enough for me to be seeing that. And that scared me.
You're thinking, why are they showing this to me?
Yeah.
And so you're seeing it, you're excited by seeing it, but you're also becoming nervous about what's going on.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And they looked like saucers. Did they give you kind of a flashback to your earlier abductions? Did they seem like similar types of craft?
Let's see. Well, back then, I didn't really have recovered memories of my abductions, so I would have to say no. But in seeing some of the things that I did see, now there is something that happened. I was camping in a place called Warren Light Center, and I had a dream about UFOs that night. And this was before going in the military.
Uh-huh.
Dreamed about a saucer-shaped craft and how it worked and the basic layout of it. You know, not an intricate, detailed layout, but just a basic one. And that was, you know, so it was very much a saucer-like craft, and a saucer-like craft was what I saw out on the test site that night.
So it looks like then our military had access to these extraterrestrial craft. Either they were being given the technology or they were probably reverse engineering it somehow. So they're flying it. And do the craft seem to be having any problem? Like, does it seem like a smooth interaction? You know, are they, you know, are we able to fly those crafts well?
Well, way back when, I thought, no, I didn't really see how a human being could learn to fly it. I mean, a human being can sit in the chair, and maybe they can get the neural interface hooked up to their body. But it's a tricky thing, because what I remember from my dream, if it's the same kind of system, you could sit in the chair of this craft, and just sitting in the chair would take the neural information from your body. And then flying the craft is just a matter of thinking about the coordinates of where you want to go, and then just kind of directing the craft to go there, just the same as you're going to say, I'm going to raise my arm, and you raise your arm.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to move my leg, and you move your leg. You know?
So it's mentally controlled.
Yeah, it's mentally controlled, and it's very natural. Once you realize that it's the same as giving your body a direction to move, it gets easier. But, you know, you have to undercorrect and overcorrect, because sometimes you might give a direction that takes you off too fast.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
sure.
Like if you're not used to riding a motorcycle and you turn the accelerator too much, you're going to be like going way faster than you're comfortable with real quick. You know, it's kind of the same thing.
And in a saucer, it's probably twice as deadly, I would imagine. That's very interesting. So you're staring up at these craft, they're advanced craft. You're becoming nervous somewhat.
Yeah.
And then what happens? You go back to your barracks, and then what?
Well, we didn't go back to the barracks. We were put on a bus. We were taken to what I believe was either Area 51 or an underground base of the Tonopah compound up there on the test site. I'm not sure which, because the windows of the bus were painted over.
Okay.
And, so wherever I was taken, let's just say it was Area 51, okay? I was put in a medical facility with all the other people that had been out on the range that night, and there was probably, I'm guessing, 10 or 12 people. We were put in a room, a waiting room with the lights off. The chairs were kind of catty corner, so if the room was, you know, square, the chairs were kind of corner to corner, you know, not all the way to each corner. We were sitting in those chairs, and our back was to this double door that had light shining in from a different hallway. And then over on that same wall to that side was this little door to this room. And they would call people one by one to go into that room every so often. And finally, it was my turn. I went into the room, and there was a security guard there with a sidearm. And he was standing at parade rest, and I was told to lay down on a stainless steel examining table, fully clothed. And then someone finally came in after a few minutes. I'm laying there terrified, so everything seems like it's taking forever. Somebody finally came in a white lab coat saying, "Stay calm," about three times in a deadpan voice. And when he got up beside the right side of my head, he injected me in the side of the neck with a needle.
Mm.
And went to the brain, and it was like being put immediately into shock.
He was a doctor.
He was something. He was okay. A scientist or a researcher or a doctor. I don't know which.
Okay. So they have you in this room. By the way, is it an even spread of men and women there, or is it just a couple
mostly
of women?
Men.
Mostly
there
men.
There are some women, but mostly men is what I saw.
Mm-hmm. When they stuck you with the needle, so what side of your neck did they stick you?
Do
you
right.
On the right side.
Yeah.
And so you're lying on this table. The doctor comes in, examines you, and then how does he get to the point where he injects you? Does he say anything?
Well, he just said, "Stay calm," that three times in that deadpan voice, and walks past security guard up by the right side of my head. And he kind of moved his hand in one smooth move. He had his lab coat was kind of hiding that, you know, the lab coat is coming down here, and he's kind of hiding the hypodermic needle in his hand so I can't see it. So when he got beside the right side of my head, he just kind of brought his hand up in one smooth move and did the injection without me seeing what was going to happen.
Oh, and I see. So he did.
If I had other times, they probably had to restrain me.
Yes, yeah.
To get it. Yeah.
Sure, absolutely. If you'd seen it coming, you would have jumped and reacted. So he plunges the needle in, and what happens?
This rush of chemical went to the brain. I was immediately kind of in shock, meaning that I was more aware of what was happening inside my body than what was happening around me. But I did become aware when two security guards came to either side and pulled me off the table by my arms, and they took me down a very long staircase. And at the bottom of the staircase, they pushed me in this little room that had a two-way glass, you know, mirror on my side, but an observation glass on the other side. And I guess people were watching me go through the effects of the injection while I was in this little booth. And what the injection felt like was, it felt like I was going to dissolve away and run through the floor. And I've also described it as feeling like my body was turning to soda pop fizz. So you know how soda pop fizz or beer foam, it just kind of foams and it is constantly, you know, having these little bubbles that are popping and forming. That's kind of how I felt. It was really, really a nasty feeling. It was a terrifying feeling, actually.
I can imagine.
You just feel like you dissolve away.
Mm. Yeah. How long did that last, do you think?
I really don't have any sense of the time. Guessing not too long, because they had to get me back to my motel that I stayed at in Tonopah for my work so that I could go to work the next day. So I'm guessing probably not too terribly long, but under an hour. Let's just say under an hour. And then when I was starting to recover a little bit and was laying exhausted on the floor, I was drug out of there, and that's when I was sexually assaulted by two security guards.
Right. And these security guards, you've said before about them that they weren't necessarily actual military officers, but they were more like contractor people.
They could have been contractor people, covert ops people.
Right, covert ops people.
You know, in the military, we have warriors, mm-hmm. you know, or there's some people that have a mercenary mentality, but I kind of differentiate a warrior who's somebody of honor who fights for causes and good things from a mercenary who just is a gun for hire.
Yeah, sure, absolutely.
And so covert ops people, these are just guns for hire.
Right, absolutely. That is fascinating, though. So you have this experience, they give you this drug, and they deliver it. It creates this feeling in your brain that mm-hmm. you're dissolving.
And actually, my whole body felt that way.
Your whole body. Ah. Mm-hmm. And they drag you out of there exhausted. And then mm-hmm. when you're in this other room, mm-hmm. Would you describe it more like a cell, or is it a room?
It's something, you know, it's like a booth room combination, maybe a little bit bigger than what you'd think of as a booth, but pretty small. I'm guessing, you know, maybe 10 or 12 by 12, you know, so not too big.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you're in there, you're exhausted, and you are sexually attacked by more than one of these contractors.
Yeah, two of the guards, yeah.
And when this is going on, you are semi-conscious?
No, I was conscious, but that's, you know, when people listen to these interviews, I don't know, people that listen to your interview, maybe they already know about some of these things. But for people that don't know, this level of abuse seems unbelievable and unbelievably horrific. But you have to really understand about trauma-based mind control to really wrap your head around what's going on here.
Mm-hmm. Because yeah. this was an aspect of the trauma-based mind control. So they're traumatizing yes. you for some reason beyond. So you think that maybe these contractors weren't just doing this on their own. It was part of the plan for you for that evening.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, they need to traumatize enough that I would break that memory off and stick it in my subconscious where I could not access it.
Oh, right. So it's too painful to think about. You won't remember. And since you won't remember that, you won't remember the needle in the neck and the bus to Area 51.
Right. Because yeah. the human body and mind is really a remarkable thing. It wants to protect us and enhance our survival. So if we have an experience that is so traumatic that we can't deal with it in the moment that it's happening to us, our subconscious will break the memory off. It will stick it in the deep subconscious where we cannot access it, hopefully until such time that we're able to handle it.
Sure.
And so they're basically, in trauma-based mind control, they're using this personality defense mechanism that is part of who we are against us. They're using it for their own benefit, to clear their tracks in someone's memory.
Right. I can appreciate that. I think that, you know, and I appreciate you coming out and talking about these things in such a frank way because, you know, I know it's a difficult topic, and especially when you're recounting your own experience, not someone else's, it must be tough each and every time. But I think it's such a crucial piece of the story.
Yeah, it's not your girlhood dream to grow up and be a UFO writer and talk about your own experiences like this.
Right, sure. But you're doing it quite well, so I appreciate it.
Okay.
So we'll continue from here and say that, how does that night end?
That night ended after the sexual assault. I believe there was like an interrogation type of setting. And I was threatened with more rape and more abuse. And they also threatened it against my then 4-year-old daughter. And they just kept kind of hammering away at me like, "You didn't see anything out here tonight, did you?" And I'd say, "What do you mean?" And I'd question back until finally it was just being hammered away at till you don't know what you saw, you don't know what you felt, don't know what you heard. You just feel confused, you feel exhausted, and eventually you just kind of break down.
Yeah, absolutely. So they were willing, they were able to... So they're breaking you through these threats and through the continued sort of onslaught after these attacks.
Yeah.
So somehow...
And there's an injection in the arm that puts you to sleep, and then you wake up in your hotel room where you stay every other week when you're working at the range.
Right, right. And so you're back, and it's almost like being a zombie at work then. You're there, your faculties are there, but there's some aspect that's missing because you're having these traumatizing experiences.
Yeah. Well, you wake up from experience like that, and you're exhausted because you didn't get much sleep the night before, but you don't remember what happened. So it's like, wow, why am I so tired? You know, what's going on here? And then you get on the bus to be bussed out to your work area, and you just go to sleep on the bus to try to catch a few Z's, you know, so that you can function at work. You know, and that's kind of how I worked.
So it's sleep, and it's sleep deprivation.
Yeah, a lot of sleep deprivation. And that is another mind control technique.
How old were you during this experience at Tonopah?
25.
So
25.
Yeah, so relatively young in this environment. And so there's a certain point at which these experiences go beyond this level, and you actually find yourself in one of these crafts. Can you tell me about that?
When I'm on the craft in the military...
How do they get you there? How does that happen?
Well, they took, for me, they took me to a hangar, one of the underground hangars. And it's a good point to interject that I saw, I think, Michael Schratt's presentation at the UFO Congress about underground bases. Mm-hmm. And when he showed the way the underground hangars were laid out, that was very similar to what I remember.
Oh,
very, okay. It was pretty sweet to see his presentation and think, wow, I remember that, how that looks.
Yeah, you're like, and I've seen that before.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So anyway, with me, they took me down into one of the hangars, and they gave me a suit of very shapeless-looking silver clothes, and they said, "Put this on." And I didn't know how it was going to go on, but once I put it on, it actually vacuumed itself onto my body and was very form-fitting.
Mm-hmm. It's like shrink wrap or something like that.
Like shrink wrap, yeah. And it had boots and it had gloves, which I just carried the gloves. I didn't really put them on. Then I had to climb a ladder into the bottom of the saucer craft. And they told me, they pointed at a place on the floor and said, "Lay down over there on the floor with those two guys," because there were two guys that were also laying there on the floor that were also going where we were being taken. And so I laid down next to them. And then the craft actually took us to the moon. And I know that's pretty hard for people to believe. And I just say, don't believe it. If you don't want to believe it, don't believe it. It's perfectly fine with me if you don't believe what I'm telling you, because I know how fantastic it sounds. I've lived as a child of this planet for many years, and I know I'm very familiar with how mainstream culture regards things like this. Mm-hmm. But I would also say that if we have bases on the moon, as it's been discovered by other government whistleblowers, and if we have back-engineered craft, has been also discovered and brought out, Gary McKinnon brought out that we have a space-based naval fleet and a list of non-terrestrial officers. So if you look at my telling about being taken to the moon within the larger context of all this other whistleblower information that's coming out, including Jose Escamilla's really wonderful film, Moon Rising, then there is some plausibility to me saying that I was taken to the moon.
Well, it's very interesting. I remember, of course, Ingo Swann's book when he remote viewed, when they asked him to remote view the moon, and he saw all these activities on a base there. And they were very worried about him being spotted by some other telepaths in there. But of course, that's around the same time that that takes place, around 1980. So, you know, anyone who's familiar with remote viewing and the idea that there's a secret space program, obviously what you're saying is much more plausible if you have that little piece of knowledge, for sure. But let's go with this now. You are in the suit. You lie down. Do you remember what it felt like when this craft was moving? Did you feel...
It was very disorienting. That's about all I can say. Someone, I did a presentation for this in Las Vegas, and somebody mentioned like a time dilation effect of traveling at high speed, you know, or warp or folding space or however this thing traveled. But it was very disorienting. If I had to hazard a guess, I would say 20 to 30 minute flight. Whoa. From Earth to... Yeah.
Oh, that's so fast.
That's very fast.
Yeah.
But I can't be sure. Like I said, it was just disorienting to be on the craft.
So they're doing interesting things with you. They're allowing you to see advanced craft. They're traumatizing you to forget it. And now they're taking you in one of these crafts in a special uniform to the moon. Obviously, you're a very special kind of research subject for them with what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. Not the only one. They pick up all kinds of people who are ET experiencers trying to figure out why the ETs are interested in us.
Uh-huh.
And, yeah.
And, so they go through all these, they're going through these motions with you to try to determine, the ETs have a great interest in Earth. Let's find out why.
Uh-huh. Well, just having that dream that I mentioned in Pennsylvania about the craft and how it worked, that would make them interested in me.
Okay.
So if they were monitoring my contacts with ETs, and they knew about that particular contact, then that would be enough right there where they would be really interested in me to learn what I know about navigating one of those craft.
Right. So they're getting kind of secret intel about the aliens from the contactees. They figure that's where to go to find out about these guys. We don't know what level of contact necessarily they're dealing with them on. So, but whatever it is, they want to get the kind of back end intel about them, and they figure that's a good way to do it. And that is a very interesting point about the dream.
Mm-hmm.
What happened on the moon? There's a base there. It's kind of like a military environment all over again. And what do they do with you?
Yeah. Worked really hard during the day. More sexual assault at night. Women are, they seem to be not a plentiful commodity on the moon.
So they're having you do physical labor on the moon, and then at night they're just using you for kind of sexual...
Just kind of passing me around. Maybe they had a few other girls that they were passing around. It's rough memories. Really rough memories.
I can imagine. Well, when people look at the moon and have all these thoughts about it, you actually have a memory of being there and these bad things happening to you. So that's a very different kind of experience.
More sleep deprivation because, you know, you're worked really hard during the day. Then you're not allowed to sleep while people are messing with you sexually. And then you're not really being fed too well either, you know. Basically a little bread, water, and what I called gruel. You know, just something not too palatable, but nutritionally enough to keep me going.
Okay, so they're treating you like a captured slave, in a sense.
Yeah, pretty much.
And having you go through this, and how's the environment on the moon? Do you remember anything about that? How's it feel?
It was pretty strange because we're brought up with a lot of ideas about the moon on this planet, that it's a big dead rock in space covered with rocks and moon dust, mountains and craters, and and there's not really much color there. And Jose Escamilla showed us that there was color. So when I was there, it was really strange. You had to like bring your mind up to speed real quick with the reality versus what we've been taught our whole life. And the thing that really bothered me, or I was really curious about, was the fact that when I got off the craft and I was marched over to a building, I was told just look straight ahead and walk straight to that building. But I'm thinking, I'm on the moon and I'm breathing and I'm looking up with my eyes, not turning my head because I didn't want to get whacked or whatever they do. But I would look with my eyes up, rolling them up to see, is there a dome up there or is there air on the moon? And that was the thing that was the biggest question for me, you know, was what is really going on here? How can I be on the moon and be breathing?
What did you, but how do you think of it now? What do you think? Do you think that there is air on the moon?
I think there is air, yeah. And I had a hypnosis session recently because I really wanted to explore that question. And what I learned in the hypnosis session is there's a form of algae that may have been specially developed for the surface of the moon. Huh. And they propagated it there, and it grows quite well in the cracks and crevices, not so well where the sun hits it directly. But when it grows in the cracks and crevices, it makes oxygen in quite a volume, quite amounts that are pretty high volume.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Yeah. Wow. And so there's pockets where oxygen is thicker than other places, at least according to the hypnosis.
Okay.
And I'll just say something about hypnosis here. You know, hypnosis has fallen into a lot of disrepute because of the False Memory Syndrome Foundation, but it's still a valid tool. And once upon a time, it was considered so valid people could use it as testimony in a court of law. And the thing about hypnosis is because it's fallen into ill repute, you get information from hypnosis, and then you kind of have to say, okay, well, that's a really interesting bit of information. Now we need to wait for other information to come along to confirm it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it's fascinating, all the things that we dig up in hypnosis. But then we need to look for the confirming bits of information that are validating it from other sources that are not hypnosis-based.
What a crucial method hypnosis is. And, you know, it goes all the way back to Mesmer. And, of course, they used it instead of anesthesia during surgery in the 19th century. So absolutely important. And the idea that it gets attacked so much, you know, is just one of those things where they probably don't want you to have the tools that will empower you. And hypnosis is one of them, for sure.
It is.
You know, I'll tell you something interesting about this, though. When you are on the moon and you've gone through these experiences, you're still experiencing mind control. How long do they keep you on the moon?
For a week.
For about a week.
A week, and yeah. The reason they do it is because that was my work rotation at the test site.
Okay.
I would be a week at Nellis Air Force Base down in North Las Vegas, and then I would be a week up at Tonopah, which is a four-hour drive north, for a week to do my work at the test site.
Uh-huh.
And or the electronic warfare range. So it was a week up and a week down. And when I was at the moon, what I learned under hypnosis was that my coworkers, who I would have been with at the test site or at the electronic combat range, were told that I was sick and sent back to Vegas. And then the people in Vegas thought, oh, she's just up at the range doing her usual work for the week.
So you're not going to be missed.
So I'm not missed, yeah.
Very well. That's well done.
Yeah.
Now, when you come back, mm-hmm. and you've had this experience, do they, you know? Well, I guess before I even go to that, do you hear anyone talking when you're on the moon besides the orders that you're given? Do you hear interactions? Are people bickering? Is there anything like that going
on? I'm sure I did hear things, but it's not really in my memory yet.
Okay.
It's because of the things that happened on the moon. The moon memories are very difficult to approach, and it's the idea of having more hypnosis to try to uncover more is a rough thought.
Sure, absolutely. Well, I'd have to do
in a way where I didn't have to go and look at the bad things anymore, you know.
Well, I'm sure there's a point in time where you want to say, you know, I don't want anything to do with that. Sure.
Yeah.
But it is amazing because when you come back, somehow you have that control again, or you're under that mind control again, where you don't quite remember that experience. You can't form any kind of solid memory. So they've done this to you again. You've come back. You don't remember being on the moon. So this goes on. You're in this base for 3 months. So do you think that you're on the moon more than once, or did this happen only that 1 week?
I'm not really sure, but it happened more than once.
Okay. So you're in rotation again some other point. They take you up there, the same type of experience.
Yeah, and I may explore whether I was there more than once in some future hypnosis session. I haven't looked at it yet.
I see.
I do hypnotherapy myself now, so I have a lot of people I can trade with.
Oh, great.
Way back, it was like having to come out of pocket for a hypnosis session, and it was a little cost prohibitive.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Well, I guess this is a good point to talk about Bud Hopkins, because when you leave the military, you go back to a normal life, except these things pop up at a certain point. You're talking with a friend. You can't remember this time at this military base. And you decide, I better recover those memories somehow. And so you find out about UFO research groups. How does this point happen? And how do you meet Bud Hopkins?
How do I meet Bud Hopkins? Well, I volunteered to help out at the Whole Life Expo in Las Vegas, Nevada in 1994. And Bud Hopkins was one of the presenters. Alex Collier was one of the presenters.
Oh, yeah.
And I kind of there. And so I went to Bud because I had all these questions about my missing time, and I was scared. I was really rattled. I went to Bud Hopkins' presentation, which was really good. And at the end, I raised my hand and I said, well, I have this nightmare from childhood about being left under a street lamp. And then I have this other strange memory of waking up with a thing behind my ear. And then I have 3 months of missing time from when I was in the military. And he stopped me about that point and said, talk to me after we're done. And so I waited for the presentation to be over. I talked to him and he asked if I would like to have hypnosis that evening. And I said, yes, I would, because I need to know what happened to me. Because I have a really good memory. And when it doesn't work, it's a big red flag.
Mm.
So I had the hypnosis, and part of the story that I told you earlier came tumbling out, up to the injection at least. I got the other piece later on in a later hypnosis session.
Wow.
But up to the injection was where I went with Bud Hopkins. And I have to tell you, I was just absolutely terrified when I came out of the hypnosis. And he... you know, he went back to New York, and I really didn't have much support to deal with these experiences. So I started going to UFO groups and talking to people and going to different presentations to try to find out, you know, where somebody could help me.
Well, it's a good point.
Yeah,
because Bud Hopkins, the kind of research he was doing was very city to city to city. There was no way for him to really give ongoing support to somebody. So you find out all these things, and you're kind of left with it. You're sort of left on your own with it. I wanted to go into one of those memories. When you're talking about the sexual assault, I remember something fascinating that's in the book. And you said that there were a series of military people who were observing one of these sessions where you were being attacked. And where you're being assaulted, and among them is a gray alien. And he's observing it also, and you have some kind of telepathic interplay with him. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, I don't know that it was an exchange, but it's almost like I heard him in my head thinking, why on earth would human beings do this to one of their own, or do this to one of their own kind, or something like that. And he was a little confused about why human beings would treat another of their own species so brutally.
So he's appalled. He almost has kind of like a moral disgust about the whole situation.
Well, actually, it's more of a scientific curiosity kind of thing. It was like, wow, these people are, you know, we don't do this to our own kind, but these people do this to their own kind. And it's like, something new to learn about people, you know.
Oh, right, right.
But I think there probably was a little bit of moral, wow, you know, these people do this kind of thing to their own, you know.
Absolutely. When the gray is there looking out, so it's, if you can describe the scene a little bit, they're looking almost like from behind a glass, right? And they're able to look in and you can see them.
But I was taken out of that little room.
Okay.
So let me see if I can kind of etch it out here since we have video.
Yeah.
So say we have this whole area here, and up here is the staircase I was taken down. Right around here is the little booth I was thrown into. And then out in this larger open area, there are people sitting in little chairs over on this side. And the sofa that I was raped on was right down here. So they're sitting here kind of watching what's going down here.
Uh-huh.
And I was on that sofa, and I was going through the rape. And I was so horrified by what was happening to me in front of witnesses, people watching, that that's what happens. You dissociate.
Mm-hmm.
And so dissociation is when you just kind of leave your body because what's happening is so traumatic you can't deal with it.
Right.
So it's kind of you detach and go someplace else. And about the only thought that I had while I was mostly dissociated was anger. I was just enraged at what was happening to me. I was an equal measure of rage and fear together. Because, you know, I'm not a woman that you beat. Just ask one of my ex-husbands.
Well, you were in the military. You knew how to use weapons. So
yeah, I knew how to use weapons. Yeah. But I'm the kind of person that if my attention was on the guns that these guys had in the room, and if one of them had been left unattended in a way that I could have grabbed it, everybody in the room would have gone down.
Uh-huh, yeah, yeah.
Because I was really, really angry with what was happening to me.
Yeah, so you're seething with anger at that point, and they're all in danger of you getting one of their weapons and blowing them away. And they've caused that unbelievable feeling in you. And that's one of the things probably that's the hardest to go back and remember because...
It's hard, you know, yeah. Because I'm really a killer, I'm not a murderer, you know. And the idea of picking up a gun and shooting another human being dead is still a difficult thought no matter what the circumstances are.
Sure.
But in that scenario, I definitely would have done it had I got the chance.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I find that story about the gray watching this horrible scene and you catching his thoughts just fascinating. It's just a really incredible picture.
Well, I think sensitive their telepathy because of other experiences with the grays. I think that was part of it.
Right. You're able to read them better because you already knew their mental patterns in a sense. You could kind of hear that thinking. But the other thing that's interesting about it is the military people that are with the gray, they're there with the gray. They're obviously not surprised that the gray is there. So they have a relationship with grays. They spend time with them.
There's a whistleblower that came out of Area 51 called Bill Uhouse, and he is no longer with us. But he mentioned a gray or a J-Rod. Is what he called this being. I think he said that they were a consultant on the technology that they traded to the U.S. government.
Do you think he was there, the gray was there with the military people willingly, or did we kind of capture him and he has to do what we say?
I think he went in there willingly as just, you know, more study of humanity, you know, to kind of see what was going on. But I do think that some of the other people that had to observe that, I think that it was a punishment for some of them that they had to watch a woman being raped as kind of kind of a way of impressing fear on them about, you know, if you're working a job here and you have a non-disclosure agreement that you have signed because all this is classified, and if you ever leak anything, then similar things are going to happen to you or your family. Mm-hmm. You know, so if they had guys watching me being assaulted, then those guys may have been sitting there thinking, God, this could happen to my wife or my daughters okay. if I ever disclose. So I think that part of those guys were, it was to intimidate some of them.
Yeah. It's a lesson and a warning, basically. Yeah. When you left the military and you recovered these memories after Bud Hopkins, mm-hmm. so you have the memories, Bud Hopkins is gone, and you join these groups, and do you learn anything in the groups, or is it that you have to find another path?
Yeah, I learned in one of the groups, the most remarkable experience in all the group things that I went to back then was looking for details that would confirm my details from hypnosis. Mm-hmm. So I went to this one group, we were all sitting in a circle, and everybody was sharing their different UFO or ET experience. And it got to be my turn. And I said, well, I think that I was taken out in the middle of the night to test the radar I worked on UFOs. And then I think I was taken to Area 51 and some kind of mind wipe procedure was done on me. That was all I said. So it was pretty general. But a guy across the room spoke up and said, they stick you in the side of the neck with a needle too. Mm. And since that exactly what they had done, I think I nodded my head and said yes, but it was so terrifying to have that confirmation that when the group was over, I quietly excused myself and got the hell out of there because I was just scared to death.
Oh yeah, there it is. It all became real again.
That's how it was. Every time I got a piece of confirming information from what I had uncovered under hypnosis, it was terrifying. It was like a sinking in quicksand feeling. Feeling that somebody's walking over your grave. It was really, really a bad time when I was getting all the confirming information. So that's the thing. You know, you have hypnosis, it's a block of information. Then you go out and you try to see what other information out there that's not hypnosis related that confirms what you have experienced under hypnosis.
Right. So in 1996... Mm-hmm. There's a video of you speaking in 1996 about your experiences. So I'm thinking that that's like an early, almost a premature version coming out. You're trying to share your story, but it takes about 18 years to really come out with this. What was the progression there? How did this work?
The interview, in my opinion, was handled very badly. It was done in shadow. But you could see my profile very clearly.
Sure.
And anybody who knew me knew that was me. So the fact that I wanted to be in shadow, I wanted my identity hidden, my identity was not hidden. From anybody who knew me knew that was me. And so after the interview was aired and I saw it, I was really upset. I was really terrified. And I just said, I'm not going to have anything to do with the media. I'm just going to try to cope with this on my own. And I had no thoughts of ever going public after that.
I don't blame you.
But, you know, when you have an experience like this, I mean, it's so staggering that you're kind of driven to try to figure out what's going on. And so I continued my research and my study into the phenomenon privately, read tons of material, did tons of internet looking around. And I was in a Yahoo group for a while where we discussed some things like this. But that was about as public as I ever got. Then I tried to have a normal life. You know, I'm like, but when you have these kind of experiences, it's like having a normal life with a gorilla on your back, not just a little monkey, a big gorilla. And you cannot... It's like a certain amount of your life force energy is bound up in keeping this to yourself and trying to manage your feelings about it. And there's not a lot of energy left to put into building a life or a career, or, you know, it impacts your ability to be a good mom, to be a good partner when you're married, because you're having post-traumatic stress disorder.
Right. I found that fascinating also, which is you compare this with post-traumatic stress disorder. That's what it is.
That's what it is, yeah.
Mm-hmm. When you think about the military and what's happened, all the militarization since then, do you think then some of the things that we've heard about with them planning to use, you know, aliens as an excuse to build up the military further, is this, do you think, where this is going? Do you think that that's something we have to deal with? Yeah.
But, you know, I'm not sure that they're building up the military to protect us from bad ETs. I think they're building up the military to keep good ETs from wrecking their parade, so to speak. You know?
And you do feel that, you know, you were saying the Greys, they were kind of scientific, neither good nor evil. You didn't feel anything evil about them. But some of their acts, in a sense, you know, abducting people and doing tests, well, it does appear evil on the surface.
Yeah.
Even if they have a good reason. And I think that you're right. It has to be a good cause. Talk to me about the Lyra aliens.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And, and about this kind of light alien family that you have, this more positive group.
Well, that's something that didn't come in until later, but around age 18, 19 years old, I started having spontaneous memories emerge from out of the blue, and the first memory I had was of standing on the beach not far from the city of Atlantis, waiting for the tidal wave to come that was going to sweep Atlantis under the sea.
Okay, and just quickly, Atlantis was a place that existed at a certain point before Egypt, before the regular recorded history. They were an advanced culture. They had high technology. And you're there during the final destruction.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I'm there, and I decided I didn't want to be where all the panic was going to be happening. And I had psychic abilities there, so I knew that the tidal wave was coming. In the morning I knew that it was coming, I went down to the beach to just meet it and try to make my exit as gracefully as I could. I could have possibly left the city, but in my later memories, it seemed like they didn't want anybody to leave the city. A lot of people did leave because they were afraid of what was going to come. But then they put a stop to anybody being able to leave Atlantis because they didn't want the rest of the population getting too scared or nervous.
I see.
So that was kind of it. But that was the first memory that spontaneously emerged. And down through the years, more memories have spontaneously emerged of this, of being part of this culture from another planet that came here to colonize Earth. And it's like my star family. And I don't know how to, short of somebody doing a Vulcan mind meld with me, I don't really know how to give them the reality of this for me. You know, it took a lot of work and a lot of peeling away the layers psychically and just really paying close attention to things going on in my life. But once I established that, yes, I am a Lyran ET that incarnated as human, I would get little messages, you know, telepathically, you know, like I'd ask a question sometimes and then I would get an answer before I finished even asking the question mentally.
Uh-huh.
And down through the years, this would happen every so often. I'd think, wow, what is that? You know, it's like I start to ask a question and then the answer is popping right in. And then finally, I realized that there were beings that were trying to get through to me. And then I had in my book, I write being down by the American River Confluence. And just trying to have a dialogue with whatever these beings were and really made contact in a meaningful way. And then later on, it was when I discovered that they were actually my Lyran family. They're here watching over me. Even when I'm going through the difficult military experiences, they were still watching over me, but they couldn't interfere because it was part of my life experience to have those experiences this time.
Do you... you know, we hear so much about the Pleiadians and them being benevolent and trying to make sure that we don't have kind of an environmental disaster on Earth. Do you compare the Lyrans with the Pleiadians?
Yeah, I think the Lyrans had a colony that they initiated in the Pleiades anyway. So there are, like, I would call them Lyran Pleiadians.
Okay.
You know, very human-looking like us, pretty much.
Yeah, and can you describe them, if you've seen them in these? This is past life recall originally that you had, being in Atlantis. Right.
Yeah.
So that's the Atlantis past life recall. Then it went further. You experienced this Lyran reality, remembering that.
Yeah.
And then now they're still around you, is what you're saying. In this life, they kind of still have a part of your life, in a sense.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, and they're a big comfort to me. I'm really glad that they're there. And it's grown into a pretty rich relationship.
Uh-huh.
And very meaningful. And I'm just happy that they're there looking out for me and kind of watching over me and giving me a heads up psychically if I need to pay attention to something.
Oh, wow. Yeah. And how have your psychic abilities increased over this time? They seem like they were opened up by the Greys, in a sense, because of those early experiences.
I think they've always been there. It's just I'm becoming more aware of how it feels to use them. And it's an ongoing process. And I'm actually getting ready to move to a more rural area because the less population density I have around me, the more this process of becoming can unfold.
Mm. Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's interesting. You just sort of intuitively know that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Very interesting. Do you think that with the book coming out, you said that you're kind of experiencing subtle backlash, in a sense. It's not so much
subtle.
That you're getting... Well, you could tell me.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about it?
Well, I guess the attack part is just feeling all this low energy. But one of the big things that happened recently was a trip to... I went on the road to the UFO Congress in February. And then I went and spoke in Southern California, did a speaking engagement there.
Fantastic.
And the people part of the trip was absolutely wonderful. I love meeting people in person. It's one of the things that I enjoy the most about what I'm doing now.
Yeah.
So it's nice to meet you too.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And then, but the driving part of the trip was not so good. My GPS on my cell phone kept failing within 2 to 3 turns of my destination, and it failed so much. It was way, way, way beyond random, in my opinion. Mm. It's like it malfunctioned much more than it functioned properly. And a lot of times, you know, when you're at high speed on the freeway and you need to make sure you get your exit, especially in California, your GPS fails right at the critical moment when you need it the most. It can be a really risky thing. You know, because either you're going to try to punch the coordinates back in and get the thing working again in time to make your turn, or you're going to have to pull off an exit and reprogram your GPS while you're parked someplace, which is safer. So it was really, really frustrating on that trip. And a couple times it actually felt life-threatening.
Oh.
As I'm, like, trying to negotiate traffic and make my turns, and then the GPS fails at that critical moment, time after time after time after time. And there's just been a lot of low energy, a lot of mental fog and confusion. And it's just been really difficult.
So it's electronic harassment on a certain level. And then you think that the mental fog is induced by a certain type of technology, right?
It could be technological or it could be other dimensional.
Oh, okay.
Maybe a maybe a combination of both. And I say other dimensional because what I'm starting to research now is I'm trying to understand why there's been such a proliferation of narcissism at the top levels of our government, of corporations, any hierarchical structure that we have on the planet. It just seems like these people, they're like scum that rise to the top. And then once they're up there, it's about me, 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 me. I don't really care about anybody else. Everybody else is just here to serve my needs. And they basically use the human population to no good end, whether it's government or whatever. So I've been trying to look at what the reason is, because it doesn't seem to me that we could be spawning that many natural narcissistic psychopaths in our population. So I started looking at the archons. And archons are these other dimensional creatures that they're mentioned in the Gnostic scriptures. And
they're kind of fallen angels.
Yeah, fallen angels is a good term. Jim Mars, in his presentation about the alien agenda, and he's talking, I think, similar about archons rather than true aliens. And he's saying when they invaded, they didn't come in spaceships or particle weapons or anything else like that. They invaded our minds, and they basically gave us their mind, their maniacal, grasping, power-hungry, greedy minds.
Interesting.
And so that's what humanity is kind of operating under, this energy. And if you're really strong, you can kind of push it off, you know. But if you're not all that strong, then they can really influence you. And so I'm really looking at that, and that seems to be something that they are not happy about. The other thing I said in my book that I think is really important is there's only one war going on this planet, and it's a war against consciousness expansion. And they are doing anything and everything they can to keep consciousness from awakening in humanity on this planet. And so we need to ask ourselves why. As we know from quantum mechanics and movies like What the Bleep Do We Know and books like Michael Talbot's Holographic Universe, if we ever awaken collectively to who we really are and what we really are as spiritual beings having a human experience, then we could really take control of what's happening on this earth and turn it completely around through the power of consciousness. And that would be like almost a whole other book to try to explain how that works and the science behind it. But it really is a possibility. And I think that's why they're attacking us with chemtrails. They're attacking the human brain in general and the pineal gland in specific. The pineal gland is our gland of enlightenment. It's the actual point in the human brain where our soul connects with the body. And it's that part
of
our...
Would you say that's the third eye there?
Yes, it is the third eye. And so if we ever truly awaken at that part of our anatomy, it's pretty much game over for these people that are running their scams and trying to divide and conquer us by getting us to fight with each other all the time. I think it really is a question that bears looking at, is why are the powers that be on this world doing everything they possibly can, almost with a sense of desperation, to keep humanity from collectively awakening their consciousness? And I really think that's why. Because once we realize that the power of consciousness lies with us and not with them, we can really change how things are done on this planet. And they have been managing our consciousness and channeling it into belief systems and all kinds of indoctrination down through the ages to actually build the matrix reality that we live in now. But this matrix reality is built from our human collective consciousness as it's been indoctrinated to be. So when we pull out of the indoctrination and we start lighting up and realizing who and what we are and what we can do and the way that we would like the world to be, then I think that we have a really good chance of turning everything around through the power of consciousness.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and somehow the aliens are tied into that also, because we're supposed to be not aware that they're there. And
right.
So that's part of the suppression of consciousness, because when you're aware somehow of the aliens, your consciousness is rising.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Well, that's an excellent point. I have two quick questions for you I didn't want to forget to ask.
Sure.
One was on the craft, when you were traveling in the military, mm-hmm. contractors going to the moon, at a certain point you did see a gray alien on there, but you also saw something else which you said resembled a reptilian alien, which is very interesting because they don't appear really in your book. They sort of show up there. So I wanted you to just tell me that a little bit about that.
I just saw him briefly, and it was he may have been a pilot, or the gray may have been a pilot. Not really clear on that.
Working together.
Maybe working together, yeah.
Yeah.
Most likely. If they were there together, I'm sure they were working together. And there are different groups of grays, and so not all of them are working with the government. But, yeah, I did see the reptilian that one time, and to me it looked like a rattlesnake. If you imagine a rattlesnake morphing into a humanoid form, that's what it looked like.
Oh, boy.
And it was pretty scary. It had very sharp teeth. It didn't have long rattlesnake fangs, but it did have very sharp, nasty-looking teeth.
And what kind of eyes did it have?
Yellow, kind of gold yellow eyes with a slanted, vertical slanted pupil.
Sounds visually stunning.
Took my breath away seeing it. It's like all the breath just squeezed out of my body.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You don't want to deal with that. Did you make eye contact with it?
No, I didn't. I just glanced at it, and then I kind of looked away, kind of like, you know, an animal will look away from something that's terrifying, hoping that it won't be noticed.
Sure, yeah, you know? Absolutely. And was it physically sort of humanoid?
It was very tall, it was humanoid, and it was extremely muscular.
Do you think it had a tail?
I didn't see in that instance whether it had a tail. Mm-hmm.
Was it wearing a uniform?
Yes, it was wearing something. But you could see the scales, too. So.
Interesting. Did it have any kind of insignia on its uniform?
Not that I saw. No.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Fascinating. There was one other experience you had, which I found very key to your whole book, which was... Mm-hmm. There was a certain point where you're being abused on the moon, and somebody says, you better stop doing that or send her back because don't you know who that is?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Meaning they're aware of your alien past, and they there was something there to that. Can you tell me that story?
Yeah. I had hypnosis with Mary Rodwell in 2010 when I spoke at the UFO Congress. And she, you know, I had been having these kind of things coming into my mind about kind of a boardroom in the Pentagon or someplace, maybe not the Pentagon, but I kind of think it was there was like a colonel officiating at the meeting. Somebody threw my file out in the middle of the room. Well, she's out there and she's talking about her experiences. Are we going to do anything about it? And he took my file and set it beside him, and he says, we're going to do absolutely nothing. And so that was, or this, it kept coming all the time. It was kind of like a fly that would come and land, and I'd brush it away because I'm thinking, where is this coming from? But I think it was coming from my guides. And so I asked Mary to that we would explore that under hypnosis a little bit. And when we did go under hypnosis, I was taken to the moon of the past by my Lyran guide for that experience, let's say.
Of the 1980 past.
Yeah, he took me to the 1980 past when I was on the moon. And I didn't go. I remember saying, I don't want to go any place. And he said, this is something you need to see. So we went, and suddenly we were there and the past, and I was shown this exchange happening between an officer in charge of my time there and an ED, very tall, slender ET. I don't think it was really a gray. I think it was some other kind of extraterrestrial, but I don't know what kind. And the extraterrestrial had seen me, and because he could see me kind of clairvoyantly or, you know, psychically, he could see my Lyran connection in my energy field. You could see the people I was connected to.
Right. Can you tell me what the quote was?
Yeah, you have no idea who you have there, or you don't know who you have there. You realize that everything you're doing to her gets reported back to her people.
And you are thinking maybe her people in this case are the Pleiadians or the Lyrans.
The Lyrans. Yeah.
So it's almost like a warning, like, Don't mess with her. anymore.
Well, it, yeah, it could have been, you know. But, you know, I found out recently that I am still getting messed with a little bit. Oh. So maybe not terribly often, but there's still some monitoring that's going on.
And do you think that's coming from those dark circles inside the contracting aspect of the military?
I do. I think it's coming from the covert ops military, mercenaries.
What do you think they're trying to find out now?
Probably, I think, just blood tests and, you know, trying to track maybe anything that they injected me with to see if there's still any trace of it there. That's just my guess.
You had an interesting theory about what they shot you in the neck with. Can you tell me what that theory is?
Yeah, I think that it's possible. I'm not sure. Okay. It's possible, but it could have been some kind of injection that would create a chemical dimensional shift to a higher dimension. So if you want to go to a higher dimension, that would mean you would need less mass. Your body should have less mass at the higher dimension than it has in 3D. So they give you the shot, and I feel like I'm turning to soda pop fizz. I feel like I'm going to dissolve and run away through the floor. But again, they isolated me in this little room and watched through the glass. And I'm thinking, why would they do that if there was not, if they didn't feel that there was some kind of something that might happen in that injection that might spill over onto the onlookers? And I believe that it could have been to try to chemically create a dimensional shift to a higher dimension to mimic ascension, so that the government or whoever these covert ops people are, they could get to this higher realm and maybe infect it, or, you know, start trying to run their games there.
Oh.
You know,
right.
Which I'm not sure is entirely possible, but, you know, if a lot of people on Earth are going to this ascension place, then the government would like to go and see what's there for them, too.
They want to control that atmosphere as well. They want to control that environment.
Yeah.
Wow. So now you have this amazing book out, and people are going to be discovering it. All sorts of things are going to happen around that. But what are you planning here for the future?
Mm-hmm. Well, just working on promoting the book, moving to a more rural area so that my psychic abilities can expand further. I want to get back into some artwork. I love to do artwork, and there are definitely more books in me. But so hard to write as this one was.
Well, I'm sure it just took so much to get that one through.
It was really quite a job.
It was worth the wait, because that is an incredible book. I really want to congratulate you on it. It is a phenomenal piece of testimony. Do you?
Yeah, that's what happened. Put it on your story for 13 years and don't go public, and then go public. You have all this information to just pour in there.
Right. Well, now it's the story plus, right?
Yeah.
You've got all this amazing information with it.
Right.
But you've learned so much since then, so I think that makes it, really rounds it out nicely.
Yes.
Do you, are you also doing some kind of practitioner work where people come to see you for healing or psychic work, or what is that?
Yeah, I do. I have two websites. One is for healing work, and it's called encounterswithhealing.com.
Okay.
And then I have another one called facingtheshadowembracingthelight.com, and that's going to be more an educational website. I'm still trying to kind of catch up with my life from the book. And that's where I feel like I'm being messed with, because it seems like for all my efforts of trying to catch up, something comes in and crashes my life.
Oh, yeah.
Like for the last month, I was trying to get my new cell phone on Verizon Network to work. It wouldn't work properly. And then finally, I couldn't even receive calls for 3 weeks.
Isn't that interesting? That's a long time.
To not be able to receive calls on your phone for 3 weeks. And it just was one thing after another. So when you have these kinds of problems continually thrown at you, that get in the way of you catching up with your life and doing the things that are necessary, like answering all the email I get. And then I have computer problems when I'm getting ready for presentations. It's like I'll go to a particular website where there's information I need, and suddenly the internet goes down.
Oh.
I mean, it's just way beyond random. And I keep getting these things that come in and just kind of take my attention off what I need to be doing and try to attend to some BS kind of thing that isn't really that important. But if it's not working, then you can't move forward with everything else.
Oh, yeah. You know? Yeah. Like troubleshooting. Well,
yeah.
That certainly is a classic way of slowing you down, especially in the middle of a promo tour. It's
right.
A pretty good tool, actually, to use to slow you down, I would think, because it's subtle, as they say.
Yeah. Subtle. I'm very determined.
Yeah, well, I can see that. Well, I'm determined to get you to sign this book, so I know that at some point I'm going to see you for that. You know, so mm-hmm. The book's out, and it's getting actually a really strong reaction from people who are reading it. I think discovering your story for the first time. Just mm-hmm. How does it feel now, having told the story and gone through the experience?
I wouldn't say I'm completely at peace, but I'm far more at peace than I was before I wrote the book, because now, no matter what happens, my story is out there. It's a matter of public record, and people can accept it or reject it or read it, love it or hate it, but at least my statement is now out there for the public record, and there's just a lot of peace in that for me, because, you know, I kind of had to make peace with my own mortality to write the book. And, you know, I don't think anything's going to happen to me. I think I'm going to be fine. But, you know, just in case, at least I've put that story out there. And the pivotal thing that made me write the book there were a lot of reasons. But one of the primary reasons I wrote the book is I realized one day that by staying silent and not telling my story, I was indirectly allowing the kind of abuse that I went through to continue for other people. And I just couldn't live with that thought. Once I had that thought, there really was no turning back. I really needed to write the book and expose, at least be another voice exposing this kind of abuse, so that hopefully someday we can get it stopped. And I really think in order to stop it, we have to start with abolishing the National Security Act of 1947 and all the unconstitutional protection that it gives to alphabet agencies in our government to do really horrible things behind closed doors and escape prosecution.
Excellent point. Yeah, absolutely. Yep. Well, there are probably so many people still in those programs, and they're dreaming up new ones. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
But at least your book is a huge warning about that, and it's a large awakening so that people can see, if they're in the military, wow, you know, I should keep my eyes open about this.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Well, you lived through the mind control and the trauma of that covert program and came out on the other side sort of telling people about your story. It takes a lot of courage, you know, so we really appreciate you getting the book out and making sure that people heard your story.
Thank you.
Great job.
Okay, thanks so much.
Thank you, Niara.
Many blessings to you.
Thank you for joining me for this fascinating overview on UFOs and military abductions with Niara Isley. You can find more special reports and interviews at www.darkjournalist.com. See you soon.